You are listening to the Rethinking Faith podcast. I'm your host, Josh Patterson, and I'm glad that you're here. I'm a former pastor turned brewer with a deep love of theology and philosophy. Although I don't always wear the label comfortably, Christianity seems to be baked into who I am. I've found a home within the world of process relational thinking and have made close friends with the mystics. So whether you're a devout believer, a questioning skeptic, a bold atheist, or simply someone trying to figure out what it means to be human, you belong here. Thank you for joining me and taking the risk of entering into this sacred space. And thank you for reminding me that we aren't alone on this journey. Let us imagine a better way to be human together. Shall we begin? Alright friends, welcome to another episode of the Rethinking Faith podcast. As always, I'm your host, Josh Patterson, and joining me today for the very first time is the Reverend Dr. John Tataminal. John, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good. I am sufficiently caffeinated.
Okay, wonderful, yeah. Myself as well. And since we're recording in the morning, this is a rare occasion, I'm drinking water instead of a beer during our conversation. I try and be responsible on this Friday morning.
fair enough.
But I have had my fair share of coffee already.
Yeah, it is 5 o'clock somewhere, so.
This is true. Don't tempt me. You see this fridge behind me? It's very close. Well, I'm excited to have this conversation. You know, I had the privilege of meeting you in person recently at the God After Deconstruction event at Drew, which was wonderful. I think I first encountered your work via the Homebrewed Christianity podcast and Trip Fuller, which is where I found out about Circling the Elephant. I really enjoyed it. So I'm looking forward to talking about that this morning. But before we do that, maybe for those who are not familiar with yourself or your work, would you mind just giving us a little bit of background information on maybe who you are and what kind of things you find yourself doing?
Well, for these purposes, I think one of the most interesting and curious facts is that I'm an immigrant kid. Technically, I think in the sociological literature, I'm part of the 1.5 generation or maybe 0.5 generation. I forget which term it is exactly. But it's the term that's applied to children who migrate with their families, and so they're not you know born here, and you know, nor are they the adults who have lived, you know, 20, 30 or more years somewhere else. So what that means is that when I got to the U.S., I had this really intense curiosity about what it meant to be Indian. And I attribute that curiosity to be the motivating force for my interest in Indian religious traditions, and therefore my whole sort of basic life work, which is to engage in conversations between Christianity and Indic traditions, specifically Hinduism and Buddhism. So I mean, that's an autobiographical snippet, I suppose, but it's the one that seems to me most pertinent to our conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful. And so you find yourself as both a theologian and a scholar, and also you're a priest in the Episcopal tradition as well. Is that right?
Yes. Ordained in the Diocese of Islands and Inlets in British Columbia. And part of the larger Anglican tradition, but I also get to serve here in the U.S.
Awesome. Yeah, so how, I guess, with your maybe just like religious background and upbringing, was that background and upbringing more on the like Indian side of things, or more in the like I don't want to say Christian because that's not the right way to make that
No,
distinction. But do you see
it
what
is
I'm
not.
asking?
Yeah, yeah,
Yes,
yeah.
it's a poor way to make that distinction, and I'm already flubbing here on this conversation, but
No, no, no. It's not an unfair assumption that most persons who grow up in India, statistically speaking, are not going to be Christian.
Sure.
But I am the part of the statistical exception, in part because I'm a member of the Martoma Church. Martoma, meaning Saint Thomas. There's a long tradition that is datable and known to the global church, you know, as early as the 4th century that Saint Thomas came to India, the Doubting Thomas, came to India in order to witness to the Jews who were part of the spice trade or, and so he came to India to witness to them. And according to the very convenient story that Martoma Christians tell about themselves, he struck out with the Jews, but had tremendous luck with apparently 4 Brahmin families. So you can see how this story establishes for the community its high caste status. So even Christians are not exempt from casteism. And anyway, that story is the thing that the tradition says about itself. We also have an absurdly particular date for when Thomas got off the boat, and it's AD 52, not 51, not 53. I don't know anything about why or how we came to have this very exact dating, but it's also part of our tradition. So I grew up in this Indian Christian church, which is a particularly strange church in or maybe idiosyncratic is the better term, because our particular branch of the Martoma Church was created under the influence of the Church Missionary Society of the Anglican denomination, who came to India to evangelize on behalf of Anglicanism. And the reformed part of the Anglican legacy. And the Syrian Orthodox folk just thought they were fine. They didn't want to be reformed. the founders of my particular church really wanted a lot of the reformed legacy, but without becoming Anglican, specifically worshiping in the vernacular, having the Bible translated into the vernacular. So those kinds of ingredients became the reason that we split off from older branches of the church. So in a way, we're sort of like Orthodox light. Apparently the Orthodox say of us, you look like us, you smell like us, but you're not us. and so we have the incense, the smells, and the bells, as the saying goes, and some of the sort of Orthodox legacy, but heavily theologically reformed because of the infusion of that particular influence. So it's actually a lot like the Anglican Church, which has all, or the Episcopal Church, right, which has all of these particular combinations of Catholic plus Reformed. So anyway, which is why I think I'm so happy and fit so easily within the Anglican / Episcopal frame. It just feels natural to me.
Yeah, that frame is something that's a little bit newer to me. I grew up in a more like non-denominational Southern Baptist type background. And to me, a lot of the liturgy and the church polity growing up, I was like, oh, well, that's just rote prayers. They don't actually count. That's lazy, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it actually, so I was a pastor. I stopped being a pastor. I started brewing beer. And recently, within the last 6 months, actually I just celebrated 6 months, I took, you know, a leap of faith, if you will, and started working in a church again, just as an administrator, and specifically within the Episcopal tradition. And my views and perspectives have shifted greatly. And I very much feel at home, actually, within the the Episcopalian space, or at least the space that I've come to inhabit, there's a lot of acceptance and openness to asking questions, and kind of, I guess, the way Derek says it is, or Father Derek, is that maybe there's a focus more so on shared worship than shared belief, if that's kind of a fair way to say it. And I've really enjoyed it. I've enjoyed learning the liturgy, and I've been doing a lot of work getting ready for Holy Week, as they do, a service every day. So I learned what Tenebrae is this year, which is neat. So it's been a cool space to inhabit. I've enjoyed it.
Yes, and I am powerfully convinced that one of the great harms that has befallen Christianity, not directly as a result of the magisterial reformation, but what follows pretty soon thereafter, is that Christianity becomes incredibly belief-centered. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that is a salutary unfolding or development. I mean, I don't know who I was talking to recently, and I said, the old Christian song that we sang in camp didn't say, we shall be known by our devotion to the Nicene Creed.
Right.
It was, it's by our love. And so the sense of the what happens to Christianity when right belief becomes so primary over right praxis, orthopraxis. I think that's one of the great harms that has befallen us. And I think this is one of the places where Anglicans and Episcopalians are getting it right. We don't get it. There are other things we get wrong, and there's a long litany, but not this, because the centrality of worship is partly a focus on, to use the line from one of my favorite hymns, it's the work of tuning our hearts to sing God's praise. That's the work, and hopefully that pays off in consequences for healing the world outside of worship.
Yeah, that in my mind that lends to a nice kind of transition into a question that I wanted to ask you, because so your book, again, Circling the Elephant, A Comparative Theology of Religious Diversity, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I'm using it as one of my sources for my master's thesis. But one of the things that you point out early on in the text is, well, one, obviously religious diversity is a thing that I think needs to be reckoned with. But there's also this maybe false assumption that gets, brought to the table when we think of religions as almost like these solid objects, right? That like Christianity is like a book on the shelf and Hinduism is another book on that shelf. Where in reality, that's not the case. And even when it comes to something like religious diversity, there is religious diversity within our own tradition, within the Christian tradition. And that was kind of like a big, like, aha, a nice way to kind of open your book. So, would you care to comment on that idea of religious diversity within traditions?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I think impedes interreligious dialogue is the work of stereotyping our traditions and homogenizing them. So if there's only one form of Christianity that is valid, and only one form of Hinduism that counts as Hinduism proper, then it's easy to construct those particular that particular version of Christianity or that particular version of Hinduism as a kind of monolith, and then set them in wide opposition to each other. So this is quite common, right? Christianity is devotional. It presupposes that God is a person who is in some way distinct from and transcendent to the world. Hinduism is non-dualistic. It rejects the notion that that God is any kind of being at all, but it's the ground of being, and that is what the self truly is. Okay, so now you've created these stereotypical conceptions of Hinduism and Christianity. There's some warrant to those depictions, but they're also vastly simplified. But once you've constructed them this way, then you can oppose them and say, there can be no harmonizing them. There can be no way of reconciling them. So I think we play this game when we pitch our traditions as singularities. There are, of course, very distinctive features in all of our traditions, but I like to say that, you know, more typical is that a minor note in my tradition can become a symphony in yours, or vice versa. That's a subtler claim. It isn't a homogenizing claim, but it recognizes that there are wildly many Christianities. And it's not unsurprising that Buddhists and Hindus warmly respond to Meister Eckhart, because there are these powerfully non-dual moments in his articulation of the ground of the self as falling into the unnameable abyss of the divine, right? So, or God beyond God even. So, you know, when you recognize that none of our traditions are singularities, then you can have a richer, wider interreligious conversation without caricaturing our own traditions. That's another great loss. This isn't just for the sake of interfaith conversation, but if my tradition is reduced to some facile simplicity, then I lose, you know, dozens of options on how to be Christian. They're all taken away from me. And I get, you know, I get a simplified, homogenized, reified Christianity. And I either say yes, or I'm compelled to leave. That's no good option.
Yeah, and I think to your point, a lot of people who find themselves kind of in this deconstruction space, you know, if you will, today are finding themselves there in large part because of this kind of like homogenized yes. understanding of the Christian tradition, where for like me, for example, I was handed white Western American evangelicalism and told that this is the Christian faith and tradition. And anything outside of this is not, right? And so when I came to question that, I assumed that I was just questioning all of the Christian church, yeah. which is this rather ahistorical way of approaching things. It doesn't, you know, respect the broader tradition. And also it seems kind of like a bit tinged with some colonialism in there, you know, where our tradition is the right one and, you know, all these other people, you know, they're wrong or different or something like that.
Yeah, one of the things I'm doing right now is writing an introduction to a new edition of the American evangelist E. Stanley Jones' first book, Christ of the Indian Road. And it's a fantastic book. It is so prescient in so many ways. But E. Stanley Jones and Charlie Andrews are the, you know, two great evangelists who were both friends of Gandhi and lived in India for, you know, for decades. And as the title suggests, Christ of the Indian Road, Stanley Jones is saying, well, there's a new, he doesn't quite put it this way, but it's partly what he's saying. There's a new Christology emerging as India encounters Christ and begins to develop an indigenous reading of who he might be. And he says, I can't yet say where this is going to go, because this is still unfolding. This book was written in 1925. But he was talking about the multiplicity of Christs that have and will emerge as traditions and cultures encounter each other. So the idea that, you know, Christianity is what your pastor has taught you for the last, I don't know, 20 years of your life, that you know, nothing can be more injurious to the imagination than that constriction of the faith. And one of the first things that I do in theology classes is to remind my students that this is a vast tradition, and not just temporally in terms of 2,000 years, but across, but also across the globe. There are multiple global Christianities, and if you don't know that, again, you're in a pretty tight take it or leave it box, which is exactly what you're saying. If I don't accept white Christian evangelism, or I mean evangelicalism, then and if that's what Christianity is, then of course the only credible option is to leave, particularly when you see what it's doing politically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you kind of see different ways of this being talked about or maybe signaled to. You know, I think a lot of the time of people dismissing other voices that they disagree with, you know, within the tradition as like, oh, well, we're being biblical. This is biblical Christianity. And that is not biblical Christianity, right? And I don't know. It's frustrating to me to see that, because the expansiveness of the tradition has been something that's been so helpful to me. I, you know, when I did my own kind of like deconstruction journey type thing, there was a portion of time when, you know, I didn't really know if I could use the language Christian to describe myself anymore, right? And I found friends, you know, within Buddhism. I started reading someone like Thich Nhat Hanh, so particularly within the Zen tradition. And that was really helpful and expansive. And then I started to notice where these elements were also within the tradition that I had grown up in. And I was like, why was I not told this? You know what I mean? So that, I don't know, the expansiveness is really helpful. And so point, uh-huh. Yeah, that distinction was big for me, the diversity within the faith early on in the book.
And the why was I not told this, right? That's mm-hmm. such a powerful sentence. I have experienced that at every level of teaching, particularly when I was teaching undergrads. It's often said with such pain and also righteous anger. Right? You have deprived me of the depth and beauty of my tradition. Why am I finding out now that the tradition is so vast? That sense of wounding, of betrayal by the people who have responsibility for my spiritual unfolding, it's painful to witness in the classroom. But of course, it's often the trigger, the emotional trigger that opens up into new ways of being and imagining the Christian life.
Yeah, I remember when I was a youth pastor, I was the high school and young adult pastor. It's the last church job that I had. I would teach students a centered set approach to theology as opposed to a bounded set. So like Jesus is the center, and then, you know, we kind of go out from there. And so what I would do is I would allow them to bring a topic, right? Say hell or whatever, and then present to them, here's, you know, three or four different ways people think about hell, and then allow them to, you know, wrestle with them together. Well, I was doing that because I noticed like students have a cell phone or access yes. to the internet. And so if they were to ask me a question and I were to tell them, well, it's just like this, they could pull out their phone and find someone else saying something different. And so I wanted to be honest with them, you know, and this, got me in trouble with other youth pastors in the area. They were not too fond of this approach. And they like were emailing parents of students and texting students in the youth group and said, don't listen to Josh, don't listen to Josh. But I think that access to the plurality within the faith also kind of transitions nicely into this recognition that we're in a pluralistic society.
Absolutely.
And pluralistic in a variety of ways, one of them being the religious tradition aspect. And so with that in mind, if we were now to approach something like an interreligious learning, one, why do you feel that that's important to that task is worthy? And then also, what kind of maybe postures and commitments do you think are helpful in approaching something like interreligious learning?
That's a powerful two-part question. I was so focused on the first because that was daunting alone.
Oh,
and then
sorry.
You added the second. Well, you know, there's a kind of pragmatic answer that I think ought to be stated. And that is, I don't really think that the crises we are living and dying through at this moment can be solved by appeal to the resources of any single tradition, even mine. And perhaps the most obvious way in which this is becoming really manifest to a lot of us is the global witness from indigenous traditions addressing the ecological crisis. There is a genuine awakening that these traditions are in particular powerfully oriented to the sacrality of life on Earth and of our mutual kinship and of our solidarity with all our kin, plant and animal. These rhetorics and ways of living and being in which plants and animals are my kin, and not just my kin, but my older siblings, the ones who have lived on this planet for far, far longer than we've ever, you know, our evolutionary appearance, and that they have things to teach us. That's not a note that is prominent in Christian tradition. It just isn't. Yes, the psalmist can speak of Christian of all creation singing God's praises. So it's not utterly absent. And this goes back to our earlier conversation, right? There's this presence in the text that suggests that we are not the only creatures capable of praising the holy. And I'm grateful for that note. But it's a note that hasn't been picked up and developed and cultivated and become central to the entire Christian way of living as it has for indigenous communities. So this is but an example of the ways in which we stand in need of each other's wisdom, quite practically and urgently. It's a matter of our very survival. But beyond the sort of practical, there's a sense that when I know that my neighbor is living out of profound riches that they possess, then my very Christian obligation to love my neighbor, I mean, it is the basic command, right? Love neighbor and love God. If I'm called to love my neighbor, am I called to love my neighbor despite my neighbor's deepest convictions? Or must I, in the very work of loving my neighbor, learn to honor what my neighbor cherishes? Right? Can love of neighbor be wedded to the love of God in such fashion that by loving and learning from my neighbor, I move towards God at the same time? That is to say, the work of moving toward my neighbor is simultaneously a work of moving towards God. I think that is one of the central callings of our time, right? To let the other teach me about what the other knows that I don't know or cannot yet know because I don't have the categories or the practices that the other does. So that brings me to the second half of your question. The postures are of humility The posture is also one of receptivity. You know that one of my chapters is entitled The Hospitality of Receiving. And that's, for me, central. And one of my sources for that is Gandhi, who routinely in his addresses to Christian missionaries says, you come to India with a desire to give, but what I miss in you is a willingness to receive. If there is anything in India that might be good, I pray that you will be, that you will open your ears, your eyes, and your heart to receiving it. And this astonishingly moving thing that Gandhi should be pleading to Christian missionaries. And of course, what he's saying is a truth that is so obvious that sometimes I think I make a career of saying the obvious, but Gandhi is saying, you know, if you give and you give while maintaining an attitude that suggests that you have nothing to receive in return, you're actually not giving, you're wounding. Right? And that core insight, I wish it were plumbed. I mean, really plumbed. If missionaries really understood, you know, viscerally and existentially, that there is no authentic giving that isn't also a receiving, what a difference interreligious encounter would take, you know? Imagining arriving on the North American continent with open arms, you know, imagining, you know, the earliest people from Europe to arrive here, arriving here asking not only what do we have to give, but what might we have to receive? Well, that would have changed everything. It would have literally changed everything and would have avoided the horrors, the genocidal horrors we perpetrated on the first peoples of these lands. So I think that posture of receptivity is probably the thing that I am called and feel urgently called to spread.
Yeah, that's some of my favorite portions and verbiage within your book was this, the humility, the receiving. I use the language of mutual transformation, which I really love that language of mutual transformation. And I guess, so for me, it's like, it's easy. I am more compelled to be open to finding and seeing the divine within other traditions, right? Or perhaps I heard you tell a story on Homebrewed about when you were with your guru and he asked you about, aren't you supposed to see Christ in the face of everybody? Why not me? I loved that story. But like, I'm open to that kind of thing, right? For a variety of reasons. But I guess there's people who are not. Maybe there is fear. Or I don't know. To me, fear seems to be the one thing, right? Maybe the tradition, the current form of Christianity that they find themselves tied up in isn't open to that. Do you have any advice for someone who maybe that's their experience, that there's a fear in seeking out the divine in the other or something like that? Because I mean, I think you're right. Pragmatically, this is where like war and violence and all these things kind of come from. So what might advice could we give somebody?
Huh. I'm reminded of how often, this is something that my wife has pointed out to me, how often in the scriptures, the phrase "do not fear" is repeated in any encounter with the sacred. The sacred recognizing that the way in which encounters with the holy disrupt and frighten and unsettle has to say, you know, angel or otherwise, you know, do not fear. So, I mean, part of what we need to recognize is that there is a call at the heart of our tradition in a direction that transcends fear. So that's one posture. But of course, Christologically, and this is something that Amos Young brilliantly points out, Jesus is constantly needing to receive. Because the Son of Man has no place to lay his head, and doesn't have apparently a bank account and a stock portfolio, he stands in need of his next meal. The exquisite neediness of Jesus, right? The vulnerability that he takes on by being an itinerant preacher in the ancient world suggests that you don't understand anything about who he is if you see him only as someone who gives and heals. In many ways, what is undetected but obvious to any contemporary, would have been obvious to any contemporary, is just how essentially vulnerable he is and how much he stands in need of and is an exemplary illustration of receiving. So, I mean, I'm often thinking about the Zacchaeus story, you know, the short guy who climbs the tree in order to see Jesus, and Jesus says to him, Zacchaeus, I'll need to stay at your place tonight. And everything changes, right? Everything changes, not because he did something fancy for Zacchaeus, but permitted a despised person to be host, right? And in that hospitality of receiving, saying, I need you, the worth of Zacchaeus is so warmly and exhaustively recognized, right? And honored that Zacchaeus undergoes profound transformation. So I want to be clear that, you know, as I've learned from Amos, Jesus was the exemplary receiver. So when I'm calling for us to be an exemplary receivers, I'm just saying, you know, be Christomorphic, be like the Christ. But extend this also to the question of receiving wisdom from persons who are not part of the religious community. And arguably, one of the central stories of the New Testament is Jesus' encounter with the Canaanite or the Syrophoenician woman, depending on which gospel you're reading. And in that encounter, the religious other says to Jesus, you know, you're not thinking of yourself accurately enough. What a bold thing, right? Jesus says, I think I've only been, you know, I've come only to serve the lost sheep of Israel. And she says, yeah, I don't think so. Right? Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the children's table or the master's table. I can't now remember precisely how it's phrased. But in that moment, Jesus undergoes a profound transformation with respect to his own sense of ministry. So at the heart of the gospel, perhaps why we're here at all, right? Rather than this remaining a small, you know, reform movement within Jewish tradition, is a Canaanite woman saying to Jesus, you're for all of us. And then Jesus being transformed in his own understanding of his ministry and mission. So I'm saying that the gospels themselves say that Jesus was transformed by interreligious encounters. So why the heck can't we?
Yeah, I love it. It reminds me of this language that I think I want to attribute it to John Cobb. But that could be wrong. So forgive me if that's inaccurate. But Cobb makes this distinction between like how we all know the difference between love and the beloved. And so if I were to introduce you to my wife, Noelle, and then I was, you know, telling you how much I love her and how great our relationship and all this kind of thing, you would be like, oh, wow, I recognize love, right? But you wouldn't then ask me for Noelle's phone number. Because you, there's the distinction there between love and the beloved. So you can see the love in the relationship, identify that with the love within your own relationships without then having to go and marry my wife. And so that distinction for me was some kind of, you know, helpful language along the way that I was reminded of when you were just speaking.
Yeah. I mean, and at least if I'm understanding you correctly and Cobb on this point correctly, he's suggesting that recognizing the beauty of other traditions in no way requires abandoning one's own.
Yes.
Right? That there is a profound way in which I'm claimed by my particular allegiances and practices and ways of being that have been inculcated in me, you know, for the whole of my life. So I am being shaped by my commitment to my own tradition. But this in no way should mean that I have to dismiss what other people have, particularly when they have like forms of belonging and affection for their own traditions. Now, of course, you know that Paul Nitter and I, probably most of all on the theological scene, are challenged because we seem to be commending forms of religious adultery because of our commitment to multiple religious belonging. Mm-hmm. But that's another question. I don't know if you want to go there or not, but it's a way of working with the same metaphor, but pushing it further, and saying that there are ways in which one can be deeply faithful to one's own tradition, but also be profoundly claimed by the beauties of other traditions in such fashion that one actually does enter into a responsible and relational engagement with the practices of other traditions. And of course, that's central to my work too, commending an actual engagement. And the standard argument is that by traditionalists is, you know, that say Nitter is cheating on Jesus with the Buddha. So working with your metaphor, he has to be able to say, well, no, not exactly. It's precisely by engaging the Buddha that he's found himself able to become a better Christian, mm-hmm. a deeper Christian. And so there are ways to engage with multiplicity, but we have to be careful about the marital language here.
Yeah, right, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, we could definitely go there. I wanted to go into the, you know, obviously into the space of religious pluralism. That's what I'm writing my thesis on. And I found really helpful the section in your book where you talk about exclusivism, inclusivism, and then like pluralism. And I don't know, I mean, we could hit on inclusive and exclusivism. I think listeners would probably be familiar with that kind of language already, but still a worthy endeavor. But I definitely want to talk about religious pluralism and different forms that takes, you know, and kind of shows up in, because you have this like beautiful Trinitarian relational approach. There's the process, like multiple religious ultimates approach. There's like the, oh, everyone's climbing the same mountain approach. So there's these different ways of engaging. So yeah, what do you think would be the best direction? I'll be a bad host and say, where's your heart guiding you?
Well, I think that at the heart of pluralist imaginations at their best is a strong sense that the divine mystery is inexhaustible. And because the divine mystery is inexhaustible, the way we practice can engage different facets of that inexhaustibility. You know, the Christian and the Muslim and the Jew are going to need to be very careful about how we say that, because we can't speak of divine multiplicity in a way that suggests that divine unity is abrogated, right? Because that would be a theological hot mess. But at least the Christian does have a sense that there is somehow both affirmations, that the divine is one and yet three. But of course, the founding fathers of our tradition, including Nyssa, are quite explicit that number cannot apply to God, right? God is not like a counting, is not a count noun, you know? It's not like, you know, God plus world equals two, because God is one kind of thing, like the world is. Anyway, I'm getting very technical, but put simply, there is, in all of our traditions, ways to say the divine is an inexhaustibility. What I add is that the way we engage that multiplicity and come to know that multiplicity is shaped by the grace-filled disclosures of divinity available in our own traditions and the practices that grant us access to that multiplicity. So there are things about the divine you will see by engaging in Eucharist that you won't encounter by sitting on the cushion. I mean, I'm simplifying, but I think there's something there, right? So when you sit on the cushion as a Zen person does, and you enter into the deep, shunyata, you discover something that is genuine, but it's not identical to what one sees by performing Eucharist. So particularity matters, and the disciplines that we engage the divine with matter, and the differences we encounter need not be incommensurable. Right. So even if they seem radically incommensurable, and of course, that's the point of the story, right? The elephant story, where it would seem that the various blind men in the original way of telling the tale encounter facets of the elephant that are absolutely irreconcilable. I mean, how can it be that this thing before them simultaneously has snake-like features, right, when the blind person grabs the tail, say, or tree trunk-like features by grabbing the legs, or a spear-like feature when a blind person encounters the tusk, right? These just can't possibly be reconciled. These are very, very different features of the elephant, and none can imagine how they might in some fashion be referable to the same reality. And that story is central to me, because I want to be able to say that pluralism doesn't require me to say, it's all some washed out, undifferentiated thing that we encounter. Because if that were so, then I wouldn't really need to know the other in their thickness and particularity. Like, the whole work of doing comparative theology and really studying another tradition must hinge on the fact that the details matter. And so my approach is that we need pluralisms that leave room for deep difference and diversity, but don't require postulating multiple realities. I'm not sold on the many mountains approach, that we're actually climbing different mountains, not least because, weirdly, despite all the very huge differences in our tradition, when we move towards what our tradition takes to be ultimate, we seem to be transformed in analogous ways, if not profoundly analogous ways. So this is partly where I agree with John Hake, right? Why do we have reason to believe that we're encountering the same reality? Well, we seem to be, all of us, being transformed in the direction of love and compassion. So there seems to be a kind of anthropological constant, even if there is theological diversity. If we're all being transformed in generally analogous ways, and we seem to be able to recognize the saintly figures in each of our traditions as akin to each other, both living and dead, right? So when the Dalai Lama, you know, hangs out with Desmond Tutu and have a good old time, there's a deep affection and mutual recognition that of the holiness of the other and the way in which each is really demonstrating in their life what Christians would call the fruits of the spirit, right? Partly that's why they get along so well. So for that reason, for that sort of anthropological kinship of being transformed in analogous directions, I don't think we're being transformed by different realities. It's the same reality at work in us, but different facets of that same reality. So that's the kind of pluralism I advocate.
Yeah, and you're, to kind of, I guess, get a little bit more into the weeds, with that, you use this language with like your Trinitarian approach or relational approach, with where you have kind of God as ground, God as singularity, and God as relation, which is kind of similar. I know this is making a different claim, but within the process bit, there's the like, if you only have three, some people bump it and have like five ultimates, but you have like, you have like the primordial nature of God, the consequent nature, you know, God, creation, and creativity. And, you know, one would argue from that perspective that, you know, when a Christian experiences a personal experience, you know, a personal divine, then that's like, you know, the God aspect or the primordial nature. And then maybe when a Buddhist is experiencing an impersonal, you know, divine aspect, that's the creativity part. So they're engaging different ultimates. But what's distinct about your approach, if I understand correctly, is instead of different ultimates, like you said, these are different facets. It's a Trinitarian approach. So the Buddhist might be experiencing the facet of God that is relationship. Am I understanding correctly?
Oh, you are. Cool. You know, when my process friends and start talking about multiple realities, my mind goes to one of my favorite Sesame Street characters, Count Von Count, you know, one ultimate reality, two ultimate realities, three ultimate realities. I'm like, come on, peeps. No. You know, like, semantically, it doesn't even work. How many ultimate realities can there be, right?
Yeah, right.
So, I don't, you know, I don't want to fall into Count Von Count. You know, numerical imaginations, because I think, this might be one of the ways in which I've also learned from Hindu traditions. There are Hindu traditions that explicitly have to reckon with the fact that their scriptures say both things about ultimate reality, right?
Right.
You've got strands of the Hindu texts, specifically the Upanishads, which are explicitly non-dual. And then you got texts like the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is talking to you, right? And Krishna seems to be suggesting that there are dimensions of his own being that are transpersonal, which is my preferred term to impersonal. But then he says, but you can address me. And it's actually a lot easier to approach me by way of devotion rather than being devoted to that dimension of my nature, which is transpersonal. So it's as though Krishna says, you know, yeah, that's really in me. And there are there are human beings, there are devotees who seek out that particular dimension. But, you know, to Krishna, to Arjuna, he says, I wouldn't recommend it. It's like a long, hard road. and besides, I'm here for you. I'm devoted to those who are devoted to me. Wow, that's fascinating, right? That the Bhagavad Gita wants to affirm that both these dimensions are part of the same infinite ultimate reality. So I think without knowing it or citing it explicitly in my Trinitarian chapter, I think it's partly my being a student of texts like the Bhagavad Gita that suggests that there's a certain economy of approach. Of like going the Gita way, like say that the ultimate reality has both personal and transpersonal dimensions, and then suggest that the way you practice will orient you to one of these dimensions over the other, right? If you're speaking to God, you are likely to encounter God as the one who addresses you in return. Imagine God as the ground of being and practice in that way, and that's what you will discover. So that's the orienting sort of imagination. So now back to my threefold. I don't get to my threefold straight. I say that we are likely to encounter the threefold dimension because of three kinds of wonder. Wonder that there is anything at all. The wonder that every single thing that exists, that isn't manufactured at any rate, but even probably manufactured entities, are marked by radical singularity. You know, your two eyebrows are not identical.
Right. Thanks for noticing. No, I'm just kidding.
it's as though there's something in creation that is endlessly generative of singularities. So singularity is a source of wonder. And then, of course, there's the wonder that no singularity is what it is apart from its relationship to literally everything else. So contrary to some metaphysicians, I really do believe in a kind of universal internal relatedness, because we are literally stardust. I mean, like, yeah. I can't metaphysically discount universal relationality, not like local relationality, because the compounds that make up who I am were forged in the furnaces of stars. So these are three sources of wonder: the wonder that there is anything at all, the wonder of singularity, and the wonder of relation. And that threefold ontological wonder points to real features of the world. This is what the world really is like. Now, our traditions don't all equally groove on those three kinds of wonders, right? It'd be more precise to say the various strands of our tradition, going back to how we began this conversation, right, might well be oriented towards different strands of ontological wonder. That would be probably more precise. But as traditions go, Buddhists groove on relationality. This is the mystery for them. And hence their affirmation that sunyata, emptiness, is the same as pratitya samutpada, dependent co-arising. Nothing whatsoever has any little bit of own being that it has apart from its being related to everything else. There's no like little inside Josh Patterson that, you know, that is unrelationally derived. Everything in you is relationally derived. And that is what makes you astonishing and wondrous. Well, focus so heavily on relation, you might not attend as much to the utter singularity of Josh. Mm-hmm. Yes, regardless of the fact that he is entirely relationally derived, he is also utterly, unrepeatedly singular. Mm-hmm. But also, it's just wondrous and wonderful that Josh and anything at all should exist. So these are, for me, the three primordial sorts of wonder. And each points to a dimension of the divine life, right? The wonder that there is anything at all points to the ground of being. The wonder that there is a principle of singularity that gives rise to the world of particulars, unrepeated particulars who are utterly unique, points to a kind of source of singularity. And this is what often is encountered as the source of our being addressed, of being spoken to, and hence something personal. And then there is that in the divine life that is relation itself, and is not a being of any kind, and can't even be figured as either personal or impersonal. You know, the spirit is weird. The entirety of the Christian tradition recognizes that the language for the spirit can't quite be captured in either personal or impersonal rhetoric. It doesn't seem to be a ground. It doesn't seem to be an addressee or an addressed, but seems to be the between. And so the spirit is the name for the between. So those are my ways of talking about the infinite in threefold ways.
Yeah, I love those distinctions. I like the language too, the threefold ontological wonder. You use that phrase. Because I think, I mean, for me, one of the like concerns that I had, and I don't even know if concern is the right word, but I was thinking if I were to and actually, I'd be interested in your experience here. But when actually engaging in interfaith or interreligious, intertradition dialogue and learning, if I were to bring out the phrase the Trinity, that to me, like, I don't know, makes that's the very, I mean, that's me bringing the Christian aspect of my faith with it, I guess. So, like, I didn't know if that would be limiting to others, but at the same time, as I'm thinking through this out loud, like, that is just, that's a part of the tradition that I'm offering, is that, I guess, language of Trinity. So the threefold ontological wonder. Yeah, it's, I appreciate it. So I have a question that, this is one that a friend gave to me when I talked to them about religious pluralism and stuff. They're like, all right, look, even if I don't fully buy it, I could theoretically get on board with, you know, pluralism in the sense of engaging with like Muslims and maybe the Jewish faith and Hinduism, Buddhism. But what about something like Satanism and witchcraft as a plural religious pluralist or something like that? Do you also have to justify and support and, you know, these traditions as well? That's kind of like a hang up for them. Do you have any thoughts around something like that?
Yeah, but I want to just go back to your Trinity point, because there was a question implicit in it.
Yes.
I want to be clear that there in our engagement with other traditions, there must always be a kind of back and forth, right? When I think about the other, I must also be learning from the other. And if I'm learning from the other, I must receive that learning and bring it back home and see how what I've learned genuinely changes, transforms, and reinterprets my own tradition. So there's a constant circuit between comparative theology and constructive theology. And for that reason, there's always going to be work that I'm doing back home, right? When I come back home, I'm like, okay, I've always thought about the Trinity in this way. Might my conception of the Trinity be transformed by what I've learned elsewhere? So that work is really not for the other. Like, I'm not expecting the other to somehow suddenly become Trinitarian. That ain't the goal here. That's part of the in-house work of like working back at reimagining in light of what you've learned from the other. So just wanted to signal that. Now, with respect to which traditions I celebrate and I call others to recognize, I think that there's no better fruit, no better test than Jesus, you know, you shall know them by their fruits.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not endorsing every tradition. That would be silly. I mean, I'm heavily critical of one kind of syncretism in particular, the one that is our favorite, that is trying to be a capitalist Christian.
Yeah.
Like, that's incoherent. It is literally incoherent, because at the heart of the capitalist imaginary is the priority of the self, right? Self as consumer, self as producer. And the heart of the Christian tradition is, in some sense, transcending the self. You know, he who loves his own life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake and for the sake of the kingdom will gain it. Well, there's nothing about losing yourself in capitalism. It is the anti-Christian tradition par excellence, and yet we're trying to be multiple religious participants of that every day. Right. And so, you know, I'm genuinely mean it. I don't know why people worry about being Buddhist Christian more than they are worried about being capitalist Christian. Right. Now, having said that, having explicitly stated that not every tradition is worth engaging, and some are actually invidious, if not toxic, I have removed the objection that I'm a kind of criteria-less person who's just throwing open the window to everything and anything that might come flying in.
Right.
No, that's not true. And no pluralist ought to be tarred with that particular brush.
Hmm.
Now, specifically on the question of witchcraft, I think among the great powerful harms that Christianity has perpetrated is its violation and utter dismissal and demonization of women's religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which attacks on witchcraft were part of, and at the same time overlapped with a removal of reverence for nature, and accompanied the work of land enclosure, which was essential to the transition to capitalism, are things that we have not even remotely begun to study. Federici's Caliban and the Witch is a great book. About the way in which anti-witchcraft discourse and the emergence of capitalism fold in together. So I actually think we have an astonishing lot to learn from witchcraft traditions. The Satanist tradition I don't know enough to comment about, and part of the ethos of interreligious engagement is, if you don't know a tradition, keep your mouth shut, man.
It's a good idea.
because the basic Christian obligation other than loving loving the neighbor is don't bear false witness to your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the Satanist traditions are fascinating, at least because in their public interventions they're often engaged in a kind of parody of the worst features of Christian intolerance and exclusivism and attempt to colonize all public space. Satanists are doing great work in order to reassert the separation of church and state, right? They're like, okay, you say that everything should be religious, well then we're going to be Satanists and we're going to actually make claims upon the public space in just the same way you're doing, because we have the right to do so if you have the right to do so. I mean, these strike me as brilliant moves and as actually liberative moves, resisting you know, fundamentalist totalitarianism. So when they're doing such important good work, I think I still probably have much to learn from them. What also comes through to me is a feeling of a kind of Satanism as parody rather than as a straight up worship of an infernal entity, right? So I that's how it comes across to me from public encounters. And so I don't know if it is the same sort of tradition that we encounter when we encounter a variety of other traditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you for going there with that question. And I don't know. I love the continued approach of, you know, humility and an openness to learn and that mutual transformation. And like you said so many times, that doesn't require one to then ditch everything you love about the tradition that you come from, but rather you can bring it back home, like you said, and in a way that, you know, not in the spirits of like appropriating somebody else's tradition, but rather to inform one's own and find that kind of solidarity and mutuality. I don't know, which I mean, I think it's important. Like for me, if these kind of dialogues don't happen and continue to grow in popularity, then we're just going to keep killing each other and blowing each other up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, fundamentally now this is no longer an abstract consideration, as I routinely say to public audiences. Persons from other religious traditions are no longer on the other side of the planet, but often on the other side of the bed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, you know, you can't, it's a lot easier to demonize people when they're over there.
Right.
And trickier to demonize people, when they're sleeping next to you. Though of course, in some moments in every marital relationship, you know, you really do think your partner is going to go to hell. but this is generally not the normative approach in relationship, right? I mean, so people are, the interreligious moment is not outside the church, right? Mm-hmm. The Jewish spouse is sitting in the sanctuary with his Christian partner and hearing you trash the Pharisees, who are the founders of Rabbinic Judaism. So the interreligious moment is inside the church now. Mm-hmm. So these are no longer optional engagements. This is part of what it means to be a responsible pastor or priest. You can't be slandering other traditions because, you know, they're in your congregation and they're sitting right there. So yes, I think these are non-optional matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, I don't know, that the, you know, slandering the Pharisees and this kind of thing, that's definitely a part of the form of Christianity that I grew up in. And I know right now within the Episcopal tradition, I think at the national level, there is a movement to kind of be aware of the anti-Semitism that has been so prominent within the tradition and actually working to shift and change liturgies. Like I was putting together a leaflet for Good Friday that uses John's passion narrative. And at the directive of, you know, the bishop, we were to use this translation that takes out, because you know how John is basically like, it's the Jews' fault, they're stupid, they didn't realize it, blah blah blah. So shifting that language I think that too is an act of this, as you called it, this interreligious moment, but also just a recognition that, like, come on guys, the Christian faith is deeply indebted to the Jewish tradition.
Yeah.
So
we kind of rejected Marcion and his attempt to ditch the Old Testament a long time ago, and we have yet to learn the lessons that come from that dismissal of Marcion. I don't understand it. But yes, our bishop in the Diocese of New York here also just authorized the alternative Good Friday liturgy. Hmm. So yeah, so this is how interfaith dialogue actually comes back home, right? Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. decades of Jewish-Christian dialogue, particularly in the wake of the Holocaust and recognition of Christian complicity for the Holocaust by cultivating anti-Judaism, which became the mother of anti-Semitism, right? It's that entire lineage and recognition of it transformed by meaningful interpersonal encounter with Jews that leads to transformation of how we worship. That's just what interreligious dialogue ought to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think a good example to kind of wrap up our time here, unless, I don't know. This was a really fun conversation. Forgive me for kind of being all over the place. I don't often write out, big outlines anymore for conversations. But for this conversation, I did, and I attempted to stick with it, but I failed. But I loved our conversation. I liked the more organic feel to things. And thank you for your work and for this book. I've enjoyed reading it. I'm going to go back through it and reread it as I'm doing my research and such. This conversation was wonderful. Actually, I was going to say, I hope our paths cross again, but there is a rumor that you are going to be present at Theology Beer Camp.
that rumor has already, I'm mixing metaphors. I was going to say left the barn, but you know, I can confirm that rumor.
Yes, I'm excited about that. That should be a good time. So if, you know, we don't see each other before then, I'll at least see you in October.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Well, thank you again so much for your time. I'll be sure to link your book. And I don't know, is there anywhere else you would like me to have people, where I can direct them to find you?
Well, they can find any number of public offerings by me in terms of op-eds and so forth. But yeah, the book is fine. They can waste countless hours of time by just Googling my name and finding podcasts and public op-ed pieces and so forth. I don't know that that's a productive use of time.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you again. And listeners, as always, thank you all for being here today. And go in peace, friends.